I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. One of the more sparkling debuts in recent months has been Daughters of Silence, a new novel by author Rebecca Fasea. In the book, Desi, a flight attendant from Toronto, finds herself grounded in Addis Ababa, reacquainting herself with the country of her birth's customs. They are at once familiar as they are foreign. She has to confront the silence surrounding grief, guilt, and pain. I'll get Rebecca, who joined me from here in Vancouver 2 weeks ago, to tell us as much as she'd like about her novel, one that has gotten terrific notices. I'll ask her about the stigma around abuse. Rebecca Fasea was born in Addis Ababa and now lives in Toronto. She's a graduate of York University, the Vancouver Film School, and the Humber School for Writers. She is the author of Wise Woman, a play that reimagines the legend of King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. Daughters of Silence is published by Goose Lane. The website for more is at RebeccaFasea.com. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Rebecca Fasea. Ms. Fasea, good morning.
Good morning. Hi.
Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having me.
So, Desi, that's the I guess the first character we meet in the book. I guess her name tag says DC. But for the purposes of our interview, so we'll just call her D, is that, because that's what everyone else calls her, right?
Yeah, at work they call her D.
Uh-huh.
When they try to pronounce out her name, it ends up being DC, but it should be Desi.
I see. And so she's a flight attendant. She's based in Canada, is that right?
That's right.
And so the book begins, she's on a flight, but they get diverted to Addis Ababa, which happens to be where she grew up.
Mm-hmm.
When did she leave Ethiopia?
At age 8. She left Ethiopia at age 8 with our family. When her mom, who works for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, gets posted to work in the embassy in Vienna.
And
so it's a migration, I guess you'd call it.
Yeah.
Economic, not even. They're a diplomat family.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You describe at that moment, it's so beautiful. She's panicked as they land there.
Thank you.
And I guess the question is why?
Panicked when they land in Vienna?
Yeah, or when they land in Addis Ababa.
Oh, you mean the adult Desi?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, because it was not the flight plan. It was not on the flight plan. She was on a route that was, you know, originating in Toronto, stop over in Vienna, Johannesburg, and then turn around and same route back to Toronto. But I don't know if you remember, there was in 2010 the eruption of a volcano in Iceland.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That grounded so many flights. It was the greatest global interruption of in commercial travel since, well, I would say since World War II. Yeah.
Right.
So because of that, while they're in midair, they get the directive, you can't land in Vienna, so they had to divert to the next nearest major international airport, which happens to be Addis Ababa. What a coincidence. I love fiction for that reason.
And
but it took forever to try to figure out, like, how can I make this, in case somebody, you know, goes fact-checking, is it logical, like, flight plans, would it be logical that that's the nearest place? Would they even be flying that close to Addis on the way to Vienna? And I think I fooled around a little bit with how it would actually be.
Yeah.
I'll ask you about
writing in just a sec, because I saw a video on YouTube of your space and how you work and the sort. But so it's been 20 years since she's been back. Is that right?
Yeah, 19. When she ends up in Addis unexpectedly, she's been gone 19.
Yeah, and so I guess all she has left is her grandfather. Is that right?
Yeah, he's all that she knows of.
Hmm.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yes, it's just him. War and all kinds of things took everybody else.
And
war and dictatorships have taken away everybody else.
Yeah, and it that in of itself, I mean, for wherever one is from in this country, in Canada, that is, that's an experience that a lot of Canadians have experienced, right?
That's true, yeah. Yeah. Often the attachment to the land of origin is really an attachment to the people left there.
So I guess she doesn't. She doesn't have, I guess, an attachment to Ethiopia itself. It's just the people.
No,
right?
To him. Yeah, to her grandfather.
And we see in a very short portion of the book at the beginning that she was only to have been away for not that long a time. Not the 20 years, right?
No, not at all. Because diplomatic postings are, the standard length is 4 years, and mm-hmm. then the diplomats get either reassigned to a new post after 4 years, or they get recalled back to the home country. Not sometimes the post might get extended, but it was supposed to be for the initial 4 years.
And so the meeting with the grandfather involves what?
It involves her going to his house because she feels too guilty to just sneak into a hotel. Technically, she could because nobody knows she's there. She's not supposed to be there. But
yeah.
Guilt is a powerful force, whether the people we feel guilty about are present or not. So once she lands there, she initially was going to do the simple, painless thing, just go to a hotel. But she finds herself unable to not go to her grandfather's house. So she hops in a taxi and goes there.
Yeah, and you talk about that ride in the cab.
Mm-hmm.
My parents are Filipino, and so I mm-hmm. was born and grew up in Canada, Vancouver.
Okay.
I remember going to the Philippines 10 yeah. years ago or so. It felt familiar as well as foreign, and those
yeah.
are the feelings that she contends with in that taxi ride.
Yeah, because there's her knowledge of, you know, the city and the main landmarks is really that of a child. So the routes she remembers are the same, the routes that her family most often took. So she tries to act as if she'll know where to go, and the taxi driver can tell that she doesn't know where she's going. But,
yeah.
So there's a bit of a, I don't know if it's power dynamic or what, but that instinct to appear as if you got it under control, while not having anything under control, I think it's recognizable to many who travel to countries where either they left when they were little or they only know it through their parents, that need to blend in and just flow through the place like a local, just by birthright alone. But the reality is different. Ultimately, I think she wins out, if I'm remembering correctly. He says, okay, if you say so. And it does come, the memory does come back to her, the way to her grandfather's house does come back to her. And she is able to guide the taxi driver. But I guess because I'm more, it's easier for me to write the more internal mm-hmm. journey of a character as opposed to describing the external world, that's a bit more of a struggle for me. So I focus more on writing what she was going through internally as opposed to describing the city and how it looks different than it did then. Although I did describe a little bit how her mother's office looks different than it did then, because it's actually important to the plot.
Right.
Yeah.
When she sees her grandfather, he's asking for her mother. Is that right?
That's right.
And at this point, Dee's mother has died. Is that correct?
Yeah. It's been about a month.
Yeah.
A little over a month.
And so I guess that's the custom, or is that just expected of on his part that she had been buried there?
No, it's not a custom. It's just his stubbornness, his refusal to accept that she's been buried in Canada.
Mm.
So it's part stubbornness and part truly not knowing what's going on. Because since he's heard the death, he's been expecting the body to be brought to Ethiopia. When he sees his granddaughter, he assumes automatically that's why she's there. That
uh-huh.
She's brought her mother's body back. But I think he also, deep inside, knows that that's not going to happen. So his asking is also a way of still forcing the issue, yeah. knowing that what's done is done.
Yeah,
and so, no, it's not custom; it's a character thing.
Yeah, and I mean, that opens up a great theme of how one grieves, how
right.
she does, and how he does.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a theme of the book, isn't it? To explore how we do that.
And how it's so complicated by what's left unresolved.
Yeah. And I don't know, you can tell us as much as you can at this point. What are some of the challenges that Dee faces with regards to mourning her mother?
Challenges that she faces with regards to mourning her mother. One, that she missed saying goodbye, which itself is so enormous. And she didn't miss saying goodbye because of circumstances that were outside her control, like she was out on a flight or something like that.
Yeah.
She missed saying goodbye because by the time her mom died, she was actively avoiding her and sort of in denial of how close death was or really truly not expecting it.
Yeah.
Other challenges is there's something which her mother has been wanting her to do in terms of forgiving somebody that she's constantly refused. And one would think that now that her mom's dead, she would feel freed from that obligation. But actually, she feels even more under pressure to do that thing that mom always wanted me to do, forgive that person. In death, that wish of her mother's feels even more heavy, not less.
I always wondered about that. I always wondered, pardon me for interrupting, Rebecca, but I always wondered about, you know, sort of these deathbed things that people say, you know,
yeah.
I hope you do this, you know, or whatever. You know, this was their final wish, if you will.
Right.
Is that something that Dee, I guess, does Dee want to do that to resolve whatever space was between her and her mother?
She doesn't want to, but she feels that that's the only thing that will resolve.
Really? Yeah.
The space. And she really, really, really doesn't want to, but she also feels like that will atone for everything else, most especially for her having sort of abandoned her, so to speak, in her last days. So it's a process of trying to get herself to the point of wanting to do that thing which she doesn't want to.
Yeah.
Like anything but that, you know.
Yeah, there's so many things in the book that you obviously touch upon that are worth discussing, but I'm treading carefully because I don't want to give away.
Yes, I appreciate that.
I've only read a portion of the book, but I'm unfortunately, when you read reviews nowadays, they give a lot away, and so
they're basically book summaries, aren't they? Like nobody asked you for a book report.
What is it like though when people read the book and mm-hmm. they're probably telling you that they glean some wisdom from it, whether it's mm-hmm. about grief or pain or healing or abuse?
Mm-hmm.
Did you set out to write a book that would, I don't know, provide some guidance or some wisdom to its reader?
No, I don't think so. When I was writing, the only thing I was setting out to do was finish the project. But of course, I did, alongside it, hope that it would matter to people in whatever area that they needed some boost or some reassurance or some affirmation or some perspective. And yes, all those areas, forgiveness, abuse, grief, family, diaspora, all these things, I hope were different points of connection that would be possible for whoever was reading the book, depending on their background. Wisdom, I don't know about wisdom, but some kind of help or company, like to feel like you have some company in the thing you carry, that someone else is out there also carrying that thing. If it did that, I'm happy. And I have some feedback from readers, people I know and some people I have no idea, but they email or send a message on social, that it did connect with them. And that's very satisfying, really, really, really satisfying.
Well, all these things that we all deal with, that Dee obviously deals with, guilt, grief, pain.
Yeah.
A lot of this stuff comes because of the silence around all of that. And
exactly.
So I'm wondering, how do we get away from that, if you will?
I have no idea. I don't. That's one thing I really back away from, being able to offer any kind of answer or solution. I'm just pointing out the problem and its repercussions. But, of course, the simple, quote-unquote, answer is talk it out. Don't sweep things under the carpet or under the basement floor. Say what needs to be said. But that's so easy to say, and especially between parents and children or partners. It's so hard to really do it because there is so much at stake, and it's easy to say, oh, that only thing that matters is that you are in your truth and you're saying your truth, but the things that are at stake are at stake because they matter. And so courage is what's needed, and on, when you're on the other side of it, then so they usually, the feeling is, oh man, I could have done that so much earlier. It wasn't as bad as I thought. And that's an experience I've had, that a conversation that it took me 20 years to work up the courage to having, afterwards I'm like, oh, that wasn't so bad. But those 20 years were necessary to reach that point of being able to just step into it. So I don't know how we get over the silence. It might be a generational thing. With each generation, it gets eroded.
Right.
Between, like, the people of my generation within my family and friend circle, we are a lot more, like, to the point with one another than we can ever be with our parents or grandparents. And they, or that generation can be amongst each other. And maybe it's because we've seen the fallout that, you know, sometimes siblings, aunts and uncles I know, don't talk to each other for decades, and then they death.
Yeah.
End of story. So we see that, and we're like, we don't want to repeat that.
Yeah.
But maybe it's the folly of youth that we think we can avoid that fate. Maybe when
down. We're not going to be like our parents or our grandparents, are we?
Exactly. You know, no, we're always going to say what we feel and da 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 da. Okay, time will tell, I guess. Maybe they used to think that way when they were in their 20s and 30s.
They probably did, yeah. The you mentioned, you know, taking the time. You know, people think, you know, a 20-year period is just, you know, 20 years. It's just time. But there's a lot of growth that goes on, too, think that we overlook. And I think we need to go through that period of time to get to where we need to get to, I guess.
Yeah, and adult, one of the advantages of having parents live long lives is that as the children grow into adulthood, the parents become more human. I like to see them as more human.
Yeah.
So having that conversation doesn't seem so scary when you're 45 and they're 95, because now we see there's more equality almost.
The other thing I noticed as I'm reading the book Daughters of Silence is that all this stuff that we're all burdened with, that people around us are burdened with, this stuff transfers to later generations, doesn't it?
It does.
And too few of us, I guess, talk about that part of it, that part of trauma.
Yeah, and it's really hard not to transfer, because if that's all you know, then how do you act differently? Again, I really don't know. I really don't know.
Yeah.
And I think we overcorrect in terms of telling children too much, treating them too much like adults. So finding that balance between, you know, maintaining that authority or distance as an adult, but also not ignoring the fact that children have feelings, children notice things, children absorb stuff. So it needs to be acknowledged. Yeah. But finding a right amount of acknowledgement for the child's age. This is stuff I'm seeing, thankfully, not with a child of my own because I don't have any, but between the children of my friends and my cousins, that it's very clear they're absorbing things.
Mm-hmm.
But how to acknowledge that and treat them like sentient beings.
Yeah.
And not just creatures that love to play and run around without overdoing it and overburdening them with information. Really hard.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have to deal with kids that you're directly responsible for, but I don't wish it on anyone.
No, I don't have, I don't have, thankfully, and I say thankfully because I wouldn't know what to do in a situation where children were in my life. I feel like why screw them up? You know what I mean?
Such a responsibility, man. Somebody's got to do it.
Yeah. What, I understand there's an Instagram account, Shades of, am I pronouncing this right, Injera?
Mm-hmm.
And did you create that account?
Oh, my God, no. Well, I have the creator of that account, nobody knows who it is. They're anonymous, and with good reason, because
mm-hmm.
That person, I think what's the handle? We don't reflect the culture, we create the culture.
Mm-hmm.
So, their whole platform is based on inclusivity and open-mindedness and having the difficult conversations. Also the fun and silly and crazy conversations, but also the conversations around Ethiopian culture that are hard to have. I don't know who's behind it.
So I'm not an Instagram user, so I don't know how it works and all that. But if one goes there, it's a place for, I guess, people on Instagram to share stories. And what are some of the stories that you've been seeing, say?
Usually the account person introduces a topic or a question. And like today, for example, what's going on there today is the account administrator, whatever, is asking people. There's a lot of conversation going on around the virus.
Mm-hmm.
And what's going on in Ethiopia and how, like, the government, what they're doing, why they're not doing more, why there's some kind of collective denial going on. There's a lot of conversations around Me Too, around, like, religion,
mm-hmm.
and trying to make change around the things that most people agree hold back the culture. Homophobia, that person's not afraid to, like, really ask provocative questions and post even provocative images that really test, like, how open-minded are you really, kind of thing. So it's really I think of them as, like, a conversation starter, like affirming the positive, progressive aspects of the culture and really questioning the stuff that maybe we need to reconsider.
And that's a place that is of, I guess, of today, that where one can have a conversation where they there wasn't that outlet, say, 20 years ago.
No, and the anonymity provides safety.
Right.
People who respond also can remain anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the account holder has gained the trust of the followers in that they don't post the account handle, that's the name of the person who has the account. They would cut that out.
Uh-huh.
So people feel comfortable really saying what they feel, which is unfortunately a symptom of our culture that it's, a lot of us feel like we have to say things anonymously. And part of me sharing my past and, like, was intentional in that, trying to step away from that need for hiding behind anonymity.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest things that the Shades did was it was the reason for the coming into being of the Me Too Ethiopia movement, which created its own account, because they asked, like, who are the R. Kellys in our culture? And that really brought out, like, thousands of stories, all anonymous, but there were a few that chose not to be anonymous. And I think that's always the final hurdle.
Yeah.
Not to tell your story, but, like, to fully stand in front of it.
Right. Writing is an awfully solitary experience, but at some point you do bring people into the process. And I understand Karen Connolly was a mentor of yours on this book. Is that right?
Yes.
And I read somewhere that when she read, I guess, an earlier manuscript, she had a lot of questions for you.
Mm-hmm.
Those questions in particular, I guess, did they encourage more writing on your part or different kinds of writing, say?
She had craft questions and also more deeper, like, questions that forced me to introspect about why I was writing the story at all, what I was really trying to say. Craft-wise, it was a really basic, nuts and bolts question of, like, how plot works, and she could see that early drafts, and I'm talking like around 2014, what I was turning in as part of the Humber program, Humber College Creative Writing Program. It was really just a sequence of characters running around doing things, which in my very basic understanding was made a book. But just characters running around doing things.
Yeah.
And it really helped me make the connection between that's not what makes a novel. That's not what makes a story. It's like the why. And then underneath the why is like, why is it important to you? What are you saying through their why? What's your why? That, I would say, was the key outcome.
Yeah, and I mentioned earlier this video that's on YouTube of you giving us a tour of your working space and various items, stuff that you've had over the years as you were writing this book, timelines. You mentioned getting, you know, the dates and things like that correct, obviously. Writing outlines, I mean, I don't write. I guess that it is necessary, isn't it, for a novel?
I think, yeah, I've heard that it's a more time... time-wise, it's a more effective way to go about it because if you've mapped everything out, then sitting down and writing won't take you as long as if you're figuring it out as you go. Because you may go down a lot of dead ends and have to turn back around, come back, and then on your way back, you might go down another route that makes sense, and then that becomes another dead end. And that's pretty much how I wrote Daughters, and I thought, okay, with my next one, I'm going to outline it. I'm going to outline this thing, and then I'm going to just connect the dots.
Yeah.
I started to do that, and already I've gone back to what I guess is natural for me, which is to just follow the scent of whatever's most fragrant.
Yeah.
So I'm a half and half outline, but then I get carried off by some discovery that happens along the way because I feel I can't ignore it. I think that's more exciting. The stuff that bubbles up while I'm just minding my business with the outline. I gotta see where this goes. There's enough books in the world. There's no hurry to cough up the next one.
What I understand too that you studied at the film school here. Is that correct?
Yeah, I briefly thought I could write movies. I went to the Vancouver Film School, and I did diploma in writing for film, television, and new media. 1-year program.
Yeah.
I learned a lot, but for some reason, I think I didn't understand that the film world is about relationships, relationship building. That's always the fiction literary work, but in terms of filmmaking, even if you're just a scriptwriter, it's not so much. It's just as much as about like building those relationships, getting the work done. It's very collaborative, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and as I said a moment ago, writing a book is solitary, isn't it? For a lot of the time.
Yeah, I think for that reason, it didn't really take.
Yeah.
But I did learn a lot about structure. I think structure, because film's screenplay structure is so rigid, right? It's like literally, like on this page, this thing has to happen. On this page, I think the thing I came away with was an appreciation for structure in some form.
Does the study of for the eye, as you did in film school, because we're about the same age, and I'm wondering, does that influence how you, say, write a book and how you plot something for the page?
Writing more visually, you mean?
Yeah.
No.
Really?
I still have a hard time with visual description, although I've been told that I evoked Addis Ababa really well at Daughters of Silence, which is a very big surprise to me because I thought I didn't, but people keep saying, wow, it really gave a sense of the place, etc. Maybe because I know the place, like, personally, that the paper description, to me, falls short. But I say thank you, I'll take it.
Yeah,
visual description is not my strong point.
I don't know, for some reason, I got a sense of what it sounded like.
Really?
Reading your book. I don't know, I guess... I'm used to the ear just as much as
the
eye.
What did it sound like?
I can hear, you know, the traffic and the I was going to say chaos. I mean, all cities are like that, I suppose.
But I wonder how much your mind is filling in from images you've seen, probably.
That's probably
a similar city.
Yeah, probably something I saw on TV, you know, or in a documentary not too long ago that's coloring as I'm reading the book, if you will.
Which is an advantage that, as modern readers, we enjoy because we've seen so much. We've been everywhere, in a way, through films or documentaries, that we don't need much to fill in the rest when reading a book.
Yeah. So you mentioned working on another book now. I hate to ask this question of authors, especially when they're flogging their current book, but... does it get easier because you've already written something?
So far, no, but also yes. No, in terms of the actual putting one word after the next and building sentences and paragraphs and scenes. That doesn't. But it's easier in the sense that having been through the whole thing now from beginning to end, I'm less scared. I'm less scared to have... I feel more free to mess about, and if a writing day is crappy and if the thing I come up with is crappy, I don't stress about it because I'm like, I know exactly at which point of the process I am at. So it's a lot more... I'm enjoying it a lot more, and that because I know how it goes now, so it's okay. It's all right. I know that at the end there will be something. It's like just a path I've been down and comfortable.
Yeah. As I was reading the book, there are... it's very enjoyable because of the way you phrase things or a turn of phrase that you use. As you're writing it, because I know it's a lot of work, are you cracking yourself up? Are you?
not with this one. No.
I
haven't.
But are you patting yourself on the back, if you will? Because there's some stuff in here that I just wish I wrote, you know?
Do you remember any of it?
Well,
can we use an example?
I'm flipping through it here, but there's a moment here where you're talking about the grandfather and D, and you condense so much of their relationship in a sentence or two, and it's not just clever. But it's wise, and it's it just communicates so much in so few words that it makes it look easy to do. But it's clear that you probably spent a lot of time writing that, if you will.
Yeah, there are Yes, pretty much everything is in its hundredth version, but some things did come, they stayed as is, so I could probably even tell you, if you're able to spot the sentence, how much work went into that sentence, or if it was stayed intact from... But thank you, anyway. Are you able to locate the sentence?
You know, I was just thinking of something else that I wanted to talk about, and I guess I've seen this in certain reviews where they talk about the voice that you write with, and they talk about how sharp it is, and when it's described that way, I mean, that's obviously you, right? Is that?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, but I mean, is that something that, I guess people bring it up because it's something that they're not used to, if you will.
They're not?
Well, this is a debut novel, and so when I read about you, they're talking about, you know, what an exciting voice this is in the literary landscape. Does that surprise you in a way that you're being reacted to the way you are?
Well, if I say no, I sound obnoxious. If I say yes, I sound totally self-unaware, so I don't know what to say. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I worked very hard on this book, so if people are saying that, then I do accept that compliment, because then the work is showing. And I do believe I have talent, so thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah.
But I also think it's partly a first-time author thing, and that probably a lot of me is coming through, because I'm not skilled enough to really fully inhabit and adopt the voice of someone totally different from me. That's why the book's not from the perspective of the grandfather, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I get a bit of a cheat from that sense. And also, as someone that's sort of between cultures and you know, I have absorbed some Canadianness from being here about 20 years, and then there's the Ethiopianness that is just innate and it's never going to go away. Maybe that combination creates a voice that they're not used to hearing, because it's not a voice that appears in book form very often.
Yes, it's underrepresented, if you will.
Yeah, so yeah. That could be why it's like, whoa, this voice. Actually, it's not that unique. It's new to you, probably.
Yeah.
So I think it's half the underrepresentation of it and half me putting a lot of me into Desi's voice.
I have to say that, because I read, I don't read very much fiction. I mean, I talked to a lot of authors, novelists and the sort, in the course of my year. I haven't read a book in a long time that is as exciting as Daughters of Silence is, in the sense that I enjoyed. I mean, it's a lot of it's tough, obviously. A lot of us, as I told you before we started, you know, hit close to home. But I'm enjoying it a great deal and can't wait to finish it. So I urge people listening to us to do the same.
Thanks very much. What do you enjoy reading?
I enjoy reading political books and the sort. History, nonfiction. And so that's my mind can't, I guess, adjust to stretching the imagination as much as it should. And I mean, but that's why I, you know, if I make myself read a book like yours, just how edifying I find it.
And, thank you very much.
And so, yeah, I've kept you longer than I said it would. I could talk all day with you. This has been fun for me.
Thanks very much. I've enjoyed it too.
I appreciate your time. Congratulations on it. It's a very fine achievement.
Thank you. Thank you, Joe.
The website for more is at RebeccaFisea.com. The book is called Daughters of Silence. It is published by Goose Lane, its author. Rebecca Fasea joined me from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.